Welcome to the Better Questions Podcast, where we wrestle with hard questions and seek to ask better ones. I'm here with two friends, Dustin Gallion, Dr. Rob Ramsire. We are in Rob's giant office. It's bigger than my living room. Rob, good to have you.
Thanks, Matt.
Dustin, good to have you.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
Yeah. Why don't you guys start by just sharing a little bit about the work you guys work together, Friends University. Share a little bit about what you guys do and kind of the uniqueness of what you guys are doing together.
So we've been friends for a long time. We were coaches together at Heston College where I was the head baseball coach. He was the head basketball coach. And we were young and dumb and didn't know anything. And been friends ever since of how do we do this leadership thing. And I came over to be AD at Friends, and luckily a year or two later, he came and was our golf coach. And over our whole time together, we've been working at what we call it holistic coaching. So coaching the whole person. How do you make an impact on the kids you lead in coaching beyond just the sport? And we've been kicking around ideas as long as we've known each other. And over the last year, we've started formalizing it and formed the Impactful Coaching Project, where we seek to help develop coaches who coach the whole person. And we're doing training and speaking, which is Dustin's forte. We're putting out weekly information on a Substack, which is like a new agey blog for those who don't know. Yeah, yeah. We're doing academic research with one of our faculty members here. We're writing some books, just a lot of different things. And boy, it's been a lot of fun. So what do you think, Dustin?
Yeah, I think you described it really well. I think one of the things that's been fun is that I'm a kite and way up in the air, and Rob's really good at holding the string.
There you go.
And so our gift sets, I think, complement one another. He's a lot smarter. I think he's more disciplined. I've been known to have fun in the room, and that helps.
That's right.
I think one of the things that I would add to that is some of this came through some of Rob's academic research when he went to get the doctorate. And when he says formalize, we started to say, hey, what do you think about that? Well, what have we learned? And so you said the podcast, you know, wrestle with hard questions and seek better ones. And one of the things that we started to do was say, if we have these questions, you think other coaches do?
Yeah.
And so that's been really fun to be curious, right, as a coach. And I think the Impactful Coaching Project allows you to be curious to help not change, or not that we have all the answers, but to help elevate is a word that I like of what you're already doing. The other piece that I would step into on how ICP I think happened is I think when you're a young coach or just young in general, you may understand some of the opportunities of the gifts that you have.
Sure.
One of those for me would be speaking. You know, spoke to over a million people. I think one of those for Rob is his ability to write and put things into application. Mm-hmm. I do not have that gift set. And so understanding that opportunity is one thing, but then understanding the responsibility of those gifts. And so I also think that the Impactful Coaching Project, what's our responsibility as coaches who have done some things really well, who have done some things not very well.
Sure.
And how do you give that back? How do you help others along that journey? And when you think about it like that, it's been really, really fun.
Love that.
And we get to do it with one of our closest friends. It's just been a blast. At a place in Friends University that's incredibly supportive of the approach. Mm-hmm. And it's what we're already doing here. So it's just, it's cool. It's just a blast.
Love that. Love that. I was listening to, sure, you guys are familiar with Jonathan Haidt, our sociologist. It's one of the most infuriating things is every time I read a book and I want to recommend it to Rob, he's already rated it 5 stars on Goodreads.
Right. Yeah.
Even there's like this obscure legal thriller I read that I'm like, oh, Rob would love this. Sure enough, 5 stars. It's always ahead of me. So, but he's got a new book coming. I'm sure you probably read it, Rob. But it's on. It's called The Loneliest Generation. It's
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Okay. Yes, I beat you to it. He talks a lot about Gen Z and sort of the mental health crisis. A lot of the things. He made a really fascinating claim that the only way to really change the tide of this mental health crisis is to get parents to see the dangers and ills of social media and technology the same way they view smoking now. So if 10 years from now they could see it as detrimental to mental health as, you know, no one thinks smoking's cool anymore. But that's not an easy thing to do. And I'm just curious, because you guys work, that's kind of the generation that you guys are working with, coaching college athletes, is this Generation Z. And I'm curious, when you observe them, work with them, coach them, what are your observations on how to communicate and lead well with that particular generation?
We have lots of thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Got a lot of taglines.
I'd start with this. My parents' generation said our generation didn't get it.
Yep.
My parents' parents said the same thing. Mm-hmm. So this conversation isn't new. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks the next generation doesn't get it.
Yep.
But they're what we have. So if we choose not to deal with it, that's an excuse. And you're not going to be effective.
Sure.
So I think that's number one. I think also, obviously, we work with them every day. We're big fans of this generation.
Yeah.
They're creative. They want to be part of a community, but they don't really know how. Because of, now I have a bent to kind of be like Height, where I blame social media for everything. But they've learned to be an online community and seek out people that agree with them. But the reality of a face-to-face conversation or living in a community, which is what we're doing at Impactful Coaching Project, really, it's trying to teach coaches how to build community.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think they're great, but the problems are very real. And there's some research out of the Barna group that we brought an organization in to friends called Reclaim Today. And they,
yeah, I met Daniel.
Yes. So Daniel, yep. And then Luke, shameless plug, who's going to be released this summer on our podcast, Beyond Coaching, sometime this summer. But some stats they talk about is 64% of Gen Z students feel incomplete without their phones. Outside the required school stuff, they spend 7 to 9 hours on their phone per day. And here's the interesting one to me, and the sad one is 51% of Gen Zers, kind of the high school aged for these Gen Zers, said their ultimate goal in life was to be happy, and 43% said happiness was defined by financial success. So you get a perspective of, I see all these really successful people, influencers, whatever, online, and that's what I need to be. And that's a dead end there. And you can, I mean, spiritual realm, relationship, or whatever realm you want to go into, that's kind of scary. What do you think, Best?
Yeah, I'm going to throw some terms out from our guy, Tim Elmore.
Yeah.
And when I do seminars on leading leaders, and oftentimes in the education sector, these are some things that just rapidly that I repeat, that this generation wants an experience over an explanation. They're the most right brain, tactile, hands-on generation of all time. They have the highest IQ and yet lowest EQ. And when Rob says EQ, we're talking about conflict resolution skills. And so when you talk about mental health and those things that go into that, and yet how, when something difficult comes up and I can't sit with someone, right? And I can't have that conversation, or and I can't feel restored, or that can't have fruit to it at the end, those things all add to that. And I think about that, and when you said that just a couple minutes ago, I immediately thought of Mitch Albom's book, Bowling Alone. And I don't know what year that came out, but he kind of says, this generation coming up.
It was like, prophetic.
Right, yeah, absolutely. That we used to be, hey, we want to get to church because we get to see each other. And we want to go to this because we get to be together. And now this online world where we bowl alone. Let me say this, and I think this is a part of what we continue to
try. I'm going to be that guy for a second. Bowling Alone was Robert Putnam.
Was it?
Mitch Albom, yeah.
Excuse me.
5 stars on Goodreads.
My fault.
Maybe, our friends at the 3D Institute.
Yeah. Maybe Mitch Albom referenced it at some point. Excuse me.
Mitch Albom wrote it much more entertainingly.
Yeah. Thank you for that. No, it's okay. I mean,
got Rob Ramsey.
Yeah, no doubt. You got fired him up. But let me say this, and I don't know who said it, but I've used it a bunch. I've often asked young people and coaches and teams this question: do you know what fear fears? And the answer is, fear fears community. And so the opposite of that is, fear wants to isolate you and say, you don't have enough followers, you're not smart enough, you've made that mistake. All the things that isolation and fear does in community obviously says, hey, let's do this thing together. Sure. Let's walk together, let's have accountability and mentorship. And The reason that I believe I'm still coaching, Rob, the reason I think we've talked about this, the reason you're leading leaders and leading coaches, man, there's community in what we do.
Yep.
And that is so incredibly powerful. And I mean, is it the most transferable skill you hope? Or, and I don't know if it's a skill. Is it what you hope for your own children?
Sure.
I mean, you hope that they encounter Jesus, fully surrender their life to him, filled with the Holy Spirit, one. Yeah. Two, be in a community of people who will continue to grow and help you walk in that way. I mean, that's community. Yeah. And so when we talk about the mental health piece and you talk mm-hmm. about social media and what you just said, my goodness, the word that comes to me is, how can we accent community? And we better be intentional about it.
Interesting. Two things. One, you're talking the greatest commandment there.
Right.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. But two, the other piece, we talk about this, and I can't really tell you why, but we're also convinced Gen Z, they in our athletic world at least, they can sniff out a fraud and yep. somebody inauthentic quicker sure. than – in the last 5 years, quicker than I've ever seen.
Yep.
I think there was a blind trust. Not everybody had, but a lot had in leaders in our generation.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's just, wow. I mean, the coaches, the leaders don't last is they're inauthentic. Yeah. And the kids bail on them.
Mm.
You know, and it's fascinating. And they're not wrong. So sure. that's the other piece where I haven't figured out why that's the case, because it seems counterintuitive to the online world, like conflict resolution skills, whatever it may be. But yet, by and large, I think they can do it.
Yeah, we were talking about community. It made me think about in Height's research, one of the four things he highlights and what needs to happen in order for things to sort of change the tide for future generations is the biggest hindrance. So, like, are you guys millennials?
You're in the fringe. I was born in '83.
Yeah, you're a millennial. Yeah. Okay,
likewise.
Okay, so we're
born a day
you guys apart. Are you guys are on the edge, but you're still alive. You're still part of the crew. We have the advantage of like growing up remembering a brick phone, mm-hmm. Calling your friends on a landline, mm-hmm. dial-up internet. And so one of the things that Hyde mentions, he says, you know, from the most formative ages, right, from like when you're 10 years old until 16, when especially for girls, like social media can absolutely do destructive things on mental health. We didn't have that challenge in the same way.
Yeah.
But for Gen Z, the biggest issue is that parents are not proactive. And so the common excuse is, well, all of my friends are mm-hmm. on social media. All my friends have a phone. And it becomes this very much, well, if everybody's doing it, it's really hard not to just go with the masses. And so one of the things he observed, which I thought was fascinating, was that schools, especially in sort of wealthier socioeconomic spaces, are recognizing some of these things, and so they're completely removing phones from the schools, making kids put them in lockers, and they're very, very strict on these policies. And what's been fascinating is, by and large, after a year of it, the kids are very pro no phones in schools. Hmm. It took time, but once nobody had it, they realized, oh, we can actually converse, wow. have conversations. And it took an intentionality on adults who have a developed prefrontal cortex, who can like make adult decisions, to make the hard decision that in the end benefited. And I just wonder, you know, it's not the generation's ills. We often, you know, like to bemoan, like, oh, this generation, they're just the most difficult. But it's the parents of that generation that really, you know, allow the things that I think often cause a lot of the problem. Anyway,
it's a good transition to Rob and I are both parents and both yeah. have, you know, younger children. I will tell you, as a parent of a 7 and 4 year old, some of the angst that I have felt in what you just said. Yep. And so some of the feelings I have are, man, I don't want my kid to miss out. Yep. Or, man, I don't want my kid to be behind. Or, man, I'm so proud of what they just accomplished. You know, I should post that so that, that they can rewatch it and others can be proud. And when I think about, I'll call those fears or those questions or those motives,
mm-hmm.
when I really think about those, yeah, those are not fruitful. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you say parents, what's intended and what's received, I think can be very different.
Yep.
Right. I don't think any healthy, sane parent would say, yeah, I'm intentionally posting or allowing this to happen so that later down the road, I can create this huge problem, for my kids. But what's being received. So I appreciate you, giving some background to that or giving some knowledge to that, because I don't think that, I would contend there's a lot of people that don't look at social media like smoking.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like the better question, it's so hard for me to discern this will be good as opposed to this will be a huge ill for my kids. Mm-hmm. And because technology's not going away.
Nope.
And it's only going to get more ingrained into our lives. And how do we make that healthy?
Yep.
As opposed to, oh, I'm just not going to have a cell phone. You know, what is the...
Sure.
I don't know what the...
yeah, I wrestle with that too.
What the line is.
And his suggestion, which is, I think is... He says, you have to have at least one third of the parents like get it and commit to not giving their kids a cell phone or a smartphone until they're in high school.
Yeah.
He's like, it seems relatively simple, but like the brains are not ready for that kind of just...
I don't know if they... our school where our kids go do something like, or is it church? Wait till eight.
Yep.
And that makes me cringe. You don't need a phone. I mean, there's going to be, I mean, heck, we were out last night and our kids called us on our Alexa. You know, there's ways to get hold of your parents. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm talking out of all
sorts. Well, and that's part of it, right? Cause height and, I can't think of the other guy, but they wrote Coddling the American Mind and their big thing, you know, we as parents don't like our kids to be bored. But what happens when you allow them to be bored? They're creative. Mm. They use their imagination. They come up with something to do that's fun. We also don't. We want to keep them safe, so we helicopter or we bulldoze. You know, we make sure there's no problems in their life. As opposed to the things that form them the most are the hard and difficult things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the challenge is what do cell phones, smartphones do? Well, they distract. You don't have to pay. They're kind of like a parent, right? I give my kids an iPad. If it's a day I don't want to, you know, whatever. I'm like, hey, get on the iPads, and they're entertained for hours.
It's easy parenting.
Easy parenting.
It's interesting that the Reclaim Today guys, so Daniel and Luke, they talked about cell phones in with their research says Gen Z kids are saying they're so tired and so busy they don't have time. And they brought in interesting data. Well, one of those things I said earlier of if you're on your phone, on technology, 7 to 9 hours a day outside of school and all that kind of stuff, time just goes by kind of fast. And you feel busy when you're really not, you know, and that's interesting implications and how it works.
I hear us talking about how much, when, what age.
Yeah.
Awesome conversation about the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life.
Right.
And so often, whether it's social media or youth sports or whatever this is, of like, well, is it good? Is it evil? Okay. And then if it is, then I almost want a legalistic answer, right? Sure. Of yes or no. And I wonder how much on several of these things, I mean, how much of that do we discern through prayer? How much do we say, hey, I mean, honestly, ask the question and be a good listener to allowing the Lord to lead where we're at in that. And it sounds like it almost sounds elementary, right? It sounds good to say like, hey, you know what? I'm going to give you an example of that.
Yep.
And I'll talk about how fruitful it is. Marissa and I have been unplugged for almost 3 years.
Marissa's his wife.
Sorry, thank you. So Marissa and I have been unplugged at our house for almost 3 years.
We've been unplugged.
Yeah, so for us, that's no screens in the house. So no TV, no iPads for the kids. Now, for work, obviously, we do that. And I want to give the caveat. We did watch the Chiefs Super Bowl, and we have watched some March Madness. Yeah, okay, games only. I don't say that, right, for listeners to say, oh my goodness, there's an example of a Christian, or we should be, that's, right. I say that to say, we started to really pray about, and discern like what is this time? What's going into that? What are our kids seeing? We had a very hard, and I'd even call it spiritual warfare without question that, that we just felt. And so we unplugged. And 3 years in, I would tell you for us, it has been so fruitful.
Sure.
And the thought for us of having a screen or our kids have that in the house, or even us. I'm not just saying kids. I was guilty of that too. But that was through prayer. That doesn't mean that Rob or you or a person listening shouldn't do that. But to ask the question, what might that mean in your life? And how do you navigate through that? And I think I was very, very much on the legalistic side of like, well, is it good? Is it bad? Okay, if it's not bad, then we're going to do it instead of really asking the question. And so just throwing that out of like, how do we do that?
I think that's an interesting segue too of like one of the questions you sent us as parents who do sports and all this kind of stuff. So we're partners with the 3D Institute, which is out of St. Joe, Missouri, founded initially out of FCA. But how do we coach from a holistic perspective, right? And I can't remember what the source was, but they cited the higher the level you go in sport, the more of a decline you see in character development.
Interesting.
And I don't know if it's any different than the social media technology conversation we're having right now of the more anything can be good or bad. And it's the boundaries, the parameters, the heart you go at it. And I think that's what we're doing in ICP stuff too, is how do we, in some ways, an activity that doesn't, no, not in some ways, in a lot of ways, an activity that doesn't matter. Sports is made up adversity. We create all these things and then say it's our life. It's so stupid. but the heart and approach, it can make you more selfish unless it's done really intentionally in how we go about it. And I think I see some parallels in these two things.
Yeah.
I do too. I'm going to come back to that in a second. I was just thinking, Dustin, that so I read and I taught a class by I taught, quote unquote. Andy Crouch has a curriculum that I used. He wrote the book, The Tech Wise Family. And a lot of what you describe is similar to the way his family operates, in that they have a TV, but they keep it in the basement, right? So it's an intentional choice to go and watch a television. But this whole thing is to avoid the legalism. And, you know, Rob and I think are both very pragmatic. We think analytically in those ways. But like your approach, I think, is very getting after the heart, right? Where what are the most formative places as human beings? Well, the home, first and foremost. Yeah. And what's forming us in those spaces? But I even think like, I think about growing up playing youth sports. Like, what was some of the most formative, amazing times as a team? It was on the bus traveling 4 hours to play tennis and who knows where, Claflin High School, playing tennis. Or it was meals after games. And I noticed and observed later into my, you know, collegiate JV basketball career, what was the bus rides? I mean, it was everybody leaning over on their cell phones. And it took away something that I think was really but let me just kind of take all that and frame it. The second question I sent you guys was about parents and youth sports, because I'm at that age now. I have a 8-year-old, 6-year-old, and we're carting them around basketball. Now it's soccer season, and I even like have this part of me that when my son does something well, I'm like, oh yeah, he's gonna be a D1 athlete. Not really. I don't have those visions of grandeur, but
loser.
I have this like, but you want your kids to succeed. You want them to do well, but you also like, this is not sustainable to like, they're good to, you know, they're already talking like travel leagues for my 8-year-old. Like this doesn't seem right. What are your just overall observation thoughts as one, parents who have kids kind of entering into that season, but also as college coaches, you know, living in that world?
Well, I'm going to start with a story, and I'll honor the city and the hotel. I was traveling for speaking. I pull into it was a DoubleTree, doing it big. That's right. Pulled into the DoubleTree, walk into the Friday evening. I spoke that Saturday morning, and I walk into the lobby, and it seemed like 300. It was probably 150, yeah. But at least 100. And they're little kids. Like at that time, I think we had a 4-year-old. I'm like, these are my son's age. And I'm not sure what they're carrying. I didn't know the sport. But anyways, I'm checking in, and there's a parent there, a dad. And I said, hey, what's all this? And he said, oh, we're in town. He said, we've got the soccer tournament. I said, oh, okay, awesome. And he said, yeah. He said, this is our 4.5 and 5 division. And I said, okay. And I said, well, I have a 4-year-old. And he said, oh, well, if you're gonna sign him up for soccer, you better do it quick. There's an 18-month waiting list. And I said, oh, and then went on to say, he said, yeah, we play the next 4 weekends, and proceeded to tell me the cities that they're going to travel and play in. Now, that's an extreme,
yep.
Right? But my thought process in that was not shame on you, not you're wrong, yep. Not you're bad. My thought process was, what's the opportunity cost here? And that stuck with me as our kids have gotten older of, if I'm saying yes,
sure.
Right, to Friday, Saturday, Sunday, to that event, what am I saying no to?
Mm.
And so again, I'm not saying parents listening, you should, you shouldn't, but I'm asking the opportunity cost on that. And so that has been a prayer for us. Like, what should that look like? What does that look like? You talked about young people, and I'm taking Chip Ingram here, someone I enjoy, but he talks about what can be more powerful than the unstructured present conversations that you have organically with your kids that come often not in a bus ride or a van ride with your family as you're carting your words,
yep.
Kids from this event to that event. But what does that look like? And so for me, when you say, what would you say to parents in youth sports? The first thing that comes to my mind is just that opportunity cost.
Mm-hmm.
And just, again, what does that look like? What is that for each family? I don't know the answer to that. I have decided and have felt and discerned, we're going to be pretty selfish with that time.
Mm.
The other thing I would say is our oldest now did a track meet last year. We did one of these youth track meets. We're like, you know what? So he did the long jump, the 25 meters, and the softball throw. Wow. That combined his activity of 3 throws, 3 jumps, and the 20 or whatever it was, 25, 50 meters, that combined was 3.5 minutes of activity. We were there 8.5 hours that day. I would change that to say our friends at 3D talk about putting a scoreboard in and before the age or like fourth grade, when the scoreboard comes into play, it no longer becomes joyful play. I will promise you the next Saturday, the neighborhood kids in our backyard, I'll promise you in those 8.5 hours, and it was more like 2 or 3 outside, there was a lot more running, jumping. Right. And so again, I sat there and said, man, is this for us? Is that the place we should be? Was that the most fruitful opportunity for our 6-year-old at that time?
Sure.
And for me, I would say no. So a balance to that. But those are the first things. So when you say that, I would say opportunity cost. And the second is identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coached our youth basketball team, 6-year-old boys playing basketball 1 hour on Saturdays, I think 3 or 4 Saturdays in a row at a rec thing. And I was shocked at... And awesome kids, awesome families.
Yep.
But I was shocked at the conversation that I was having with my son, not anybody else, but my son, before and after games that dealt with identity.
Mm.
Of identities being formed already based on a 40-minute rec basketball game as a 6-year-old.
Mm.
And so one would be opportunity cost, and then two would be just being really aware of what identities are we forming already through sports.
No, that's
with 6-year-olds who don't know what a foul line is.
Yeah.
Rob?
I think you said it well. I'll add 2 things. One, my parenting advice to people is don't sell your soul to it, but define yourself by the conversations after the game.
Mm.
Like I'm
really good.
Very intentional after the game with my son, and daughters. I don't coach them. You actually do most of the time. I intentionally stay out of that.
Yeah.
I struggle with parents in those environments, so I go run the clock or do whatever to stay out of that. But we always make our kids go say thank you to the official.
Your kids and then are we very ask, good about
did
that.
Did you try your best and did you have fun? And then we leave it.
Mm-hmm.
And and I'm hoping, I don't know if I'm right, that that provides a healthy frame yeah. of what matters for them, and a kind of an attitude of gratefulness. Mm-hmm. And I think the other piece is viewing sports through the right context. So I coached college baseball for about the first decade of my career and dove in to the sports psychology side. And my favorite guy was a guy named Ken Revizza, and mm-hmm. he was a sports psychologist at Cal State Fullerton. And also was a faculty member, I think, but they had like the worst team ever to win a College World Series by record. That was his claim to fame. Hmm. But he used to always do an exercise he wrote about of describe sport to me. Hmm. So I'm going to play that with you right now. Hmm. I'm a Martian from outer space. I come to Earth for the first time. I go to a basketball game. Describe basketball to me.
Oh, man. This is a... Put me on the spot here. Basketball. There is a ball.
What's a ball?
Ball is a thing you bounce off the ground and you try to put it in a basket.
What's a basket?
It is a circle.
See,
with a net.
It's stupid.
Right?
The whole thing. It's all ridiculous. And if you can look at it through that frame,
yeah.
I think you can see it for what it is,
sure,
a little bit.
Sure.
So I don't know. I feel like we've given a lot of verbal vomit on this question.
I disagree. I think yeah. you guys have been actually really succinct in your answers. I am asking as a non-expert who is entering into this world, and I know a lot of our listeners are parents who drive their kids, and this is not a judgment, but they drive their kids to Kansas City every weekend to play soccer and to do things, and I know they wrestle with it. Mm-hmm. And they wrestle with even missing church occasionally, yeah. and you know, like just the pressures of all that.
But can we go to that?
Yeah,
can we go to the timepiece? I also think one thing we haven't done, Rob, you just said, you know, sports are silly, and I think we would all agree, I keep saying transferable skills, but the transferable yep. skills, the life lessons,
yes.
the things that we can
learn.
Can
be unbelievably powerful.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And in that coaching a bunch of first graders, mm-hmm. our question was, number one, did you have fun? Mm-hmm. Number two, were you a great teammate? And three, yep. did you work hard? But then as a coach of a first grade team, my number one goal was not to win. It was to catch kids, to catch these young people on both teams,
sure.
to catch them doing those things and affirm the heck out of them. Yeah. Great job. Like you, right? And
right.
so that changes that. But you just said the timepiece.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at a calendar of events, Marissa and I, my wife, of what the summer could look like. And again, yeah. this is for us. But if we said yes
right.
to all the really great and good-hearted invites that our oldest had for baseball, mm-hmm. swim, soccer, golf, and yeah. basketball, I mean, literally, if we did it at the highest level, from May 31st to about August 15, we would take a sabbatical from church. Mm-hmm. We would take a sabbatical every weekend from other family
sure.
things and be there. And so you'll know the church statistics better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's this, hey, we got to get more young men at from 20 to 27, I think, is mm-hmm. back active in church. Yet, I would ask the question, like, well, what have we modeled?
Right.
I would further that and say with this generation, we just said they want an experience over an explanation. And I wonder if in the church body, if we could be critical for a moment or at least help mm-hmm. elevate to say, what is the experience of young people, Generation Z, when they go to church?
Sure.
And are we as a church, capital C, are we limiting what can happen on a Sunday? So I don't want to get weird, but if I said to you, hey, this Sunday, mm-hmm. like this Sunday, Jesus was going to be at
right.
at your church.
Mm-hmm.
And if people believe that, I believe not only would they show up, but I believe they bring somebody.
Sure.
And if we said, hey, Jesus is going to be there, by the way, three things likely will happen. There'll be healing, restoration, and renewal mm-hmm. for people. I have a feeling
yep.
it'd be hard to find a seat. And yet somewhere along the line, and I'm putting my hand up in this, mm-hmm. we've prepared such an unbelievable message. And I mean, the transitions are great and the knowledge is there. That we just know people got to have this week and mm-hmm. get out of there with their three parts to live better that week.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask the question, is church a place right now where people are saying, hey, I'm experiencing Jesus, not just talking about him, but experiencing him? And I mean, if we believe John 14, right? Yeah. If we believe the Holy Spirit can be there and it's better than, Jesus said, I'll leave you something better than I. And these are the last words he shared with the disciples. Some of that I would say, time and priority. I would also ask, as active members of the church, man, what are we preparing for on Sundays?
Here's another interesting slant to it. So we interviewed somebody at Friends for a Job once who he was sharing personal stuff at the beginning of the interview. He's talking about, my kids are really into rodeo. I mean, I'm as far from a rodeo guy as there is, right? but he keeps talking about his faith. He goes, we ran the cowboy church. Well, and finally I'm like, what's the cowboy church? And he goes, well, the circuit of the rodeo, you're on the road every weekend like any other youth sport. And we have a church service at the, I don't know what they call it, at the thing, you know? And
I don't know what it's called.
At the stable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm feeling a little uncomfortable even talking about these things. I'm so far out of my depth. But there was a community of families that said, on Sunday mornings before the competition, we're going to gather and we're going to worship. And somebody led it. That probably shouldn't be saying this as a member of your church and you're my pastor and all that kind of stuff. But there are ways to do it where that became their church family.
Yep. No, and absolutely.
There's just a lot of ways to look at it. To be creative. I don't think me and my wife and her kids would be the ones that are out every weekend. I don't think that's the right route for our family. But I challenge the people that feel like that is, how do you still worship as a family?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a challenge. It's a real challenge. And I think there are some creative ways. I also think that there's something powerful about prioritizing. I grew up, there were times I played, when I did traveling basketball in the fifth grade, my dad was a high school coach at the time. And I was the kid who on Sundays didn't go to the games. And at the time, I didn't think too much of it, but it was a little annoying. But in hindsight, I see what my parents were doing. And by doing that, and we kind of, and you know, we could get away with it because my dad was the head coach of the high school team, so he kind of had some clout. But I do think there's something powerful about that, and
And putting my friend's AD hat on, if you're doing all this stuff at that age or older, thinking a college scholarship's at the end of the tunnel, you're wasting your time.
Yeah, I will say
it's probably there if they're good enough either way,
right?
But if you think a scholarship or the college level is only in reach if you're playing travel, whatever, in fourth grade, Matt put my contact info in the show notes. I'd love to have a conversation because I think as an industry, we're feeding a lie there.
I think you're right. Yeah. I will say, just to kind of go full circle on this question, I do see in my, because I was a three-sport athlete in high school. I played, you know, a little bit of college athletics, but I see the value of team sports. Absolutely. And I see the value, like even me as a, you know, when you're a teenager, the exercise is so good, the camaraderie, the friendships. I remember one of the most formative things for me was conditioning, especially at the college level. First day, you know, throwing up into a trash bin, having to push through like to mental heights that I've never pushed through before. Even the other day, as I was in my room with chills, running a fever, I was just super sick. I was like brought back to that moment of like, I can get through this. I got through college conditioning, right? I'm like brought back to these moments that were really hard where I had to learn perseverance and learn to push through mental limits. There's something very formative about that and the camaraderie that's built in team sports, friendships. So I do see the value in it. I just think when it becomes an idol, and it becomes identity, and it becomes, you know, beyond, it's an unfair expectation that I think parents often put on their kids because their success almost is dependent on their kid's success. Yeah. And that's a hard weight to put on a
kid. Yeah, I don't want to come across in any way where we both make our living in sports. Yeah, so correct. In some level. So
for sure.
We see value, and I think it's, again, the frame is the word we keep using.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes back to when you're talking about height and the taking the phones out of the school.
Yeah.
The adults have to be the adults in the room.
Yes.
And I mean, Dustin is the professional speaker, unbelievable. And he said when we were developing this impactful coaching project stuff that we need to have something three as a tagline. So we have the three C's of coaching. Mm. And this plays in competence. So you have to know what you're talking about. And there's a lot of layers in that in the social media age. Second one is care, cultivating an environment of care and a system of care. And then the third is constant. Are you the same person all the time? And competence probably has to do with winning. The other two is about creating a healthy community environment where people can excel. And it's not like, I think there's an outcome of winning if you do it really well, but that's not the focus.
Yeah.
And that's where we get really passionate. And how do we help people avoid the identity issues and do it in a healthy way from a healthy perspective, which in the end, the people that want to win and say all this kind of stuff, it actually, I think, gets you there. But yeah, it's not the focus.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think well said. I don't want anyone listening saying that. Someone once said sport when done well is can be life-changing. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. I think the done well piece has different factors of age and time.
Yep.
Right? And what we're accenting. Yeah. Some of those things change and grow with age and the level of sport.
Sure.
The other thing that you asked about Gen Z, I wrote this down as we were talking, but be real, be brief. And did I say be real?
Love it.
And one of the things we talk about in ICP through those three C's is, yeah, I mean, there has to be that genuine piece is wildly important with any generation, but this one especially.
Speak to the be brief. What's the thing behind that?
Well, that's Rob's through several different things that he encourages coaches to do, but it's... I'm a guy who's not always very brief.
Oh, no, I am. My brother was saying that Rob leaves the most efficient and to the point meeting he's ever seen.
Yeah.
I always criticize your brother that he goes too long.
Yeah, there you go.
He always asks me to evaluate his sermons when he gives them.
Sure.
But talking the coaching perspective, I think some of it comes down. No, I am too brief by nature. Yeah. So some of this is my bias. But within the coaching world, a lot of the harm comes from reacting emotionally,
yeah,
whether you're a parent, whether you're a coach, whether you're whatever. And I joke with people, when I got out of coaching, one of the nice things was I didn't have to go back to an 18-year-old kid once a week and apologize saying, yeah, dude, I lost my cool. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But how do we put rules in place to where we safeguard against those moments? Because one bad moment can wreck a relationship, mm-hmm, especially when you're an authority figure.
Sure.
So an example I'll give, we have an unbelievable football coach here named Terry Harrison. Mm-hmm. And his first year, we had played it was a bad game. We lost. And I walk out there thinking he's going to appropriately get after him pretty good. And he maybe went 2 minutes. He did their basic. We can talk about it later if we need to, but did their put ups, talked about a game changing play, clapped for their parents for coming. And that was it. I was like, oh, that was interesting. Talking afterwards, like, I thought you'd get after him. And he was like, you know, I learned a long time ago, I'm only going to say things I regret in those moments. So we ritualized the post game.
Hmm.
And I thought it was like, that's ingenious.
Yeah.
So starting to work it in, but I have to have open minds from coaches because it's so different. Right. I don't think a coach should talk for more than 2 minutes after a game.
Yeah.
I don't think they should talk for 2 minutes after practice. One, to safeguard from the emotion.
Yep.
But also, kids are tired and ready to go see their parents and their girlfriends or their boyfriends or whatever. So they're not listening. So what are we doing except for a coach is pissed and wants to feel better?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing, it's probably intuitively how I ended up with how I talk to my kids after a game. Say thank you to the officials. Did you have fun? Did you try your best?
Yeah.
And then let's go get ice cream or whatever it may be.
No, that I say that. That's a brief preview, not intentionally, but like the competence piece.
Yeah.
I'd coach for 15 years, had success at basketball, had success already in golf. And it's like, oh, wow. Yeah, I'm not – that's when I'm not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Someone you know, Dean Jaderson, uh-huh, once told me, Dustin, after you lose a ball game, you're going to be heated and you're probably going to say some stuff that when you watch film, it may be the opposite. And I don't – when he said that to me, yeah, I don't know how many times – after a basketball game, I took a one snapshot moment of a high intense,
sure,
and said, hey, we didn't do that. And then when I actually reviewed the film, looked at the stats, mm-hmm, like, well, actually, we did that really well. Well, I've lost credibility there.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And so part of that, I mean, that's a piece of competence and care, but like, We didn't know how to do that.
Yeah. I think another example, and I'll go back to Ken Revizza, that sports psychologist guy talked about. Again, baseball, that's my old world. And one thing he talked about was, think about the pitcher, right? Mm-hmm. Hard to do. And one of the things, and youth coaches, don't do this. If you think everything's stupid, this one's not. When a coach yells at a pitcher to throw strikes. So here's the pitcher. He is out in the center of the field. In baseball, you're on an elevated spot of the field. All eyes are on you. And by and large, the game depends on you, win or lose. That person is not trying to screw up. You know? Now, their preparation could have been bad, all this kind of stuff. But in that moment, they are trying to throw strikes. They are not trying to mess up.
That's a good point.
So what boundaries do you have in place to deal with that? And after the game, as a parent or a coach?
Right.
You know, kids' preparation can be bad. They don't put in the work necessary to be successful. Sure. That's the transferable skills, the learning, all that kind of stuff. But don't wreck that person in the moment.
Sure.
Because at least in that moment, I'll try and correct it tomorrow.
Yeah. I remember a basketball game. We were playing Barton Community College. And I was a shooting guard, known for decent three-point shooting percent.
So was I.
Yes. And I went 0 for 11. Just kept shooting. And at one point, the JV coach looks at me and he's like, Matt, stop shooting. Or he's like, if you shoot again, you better make it. And I just remember thinking, I'm trying to make a shot. And I'm like, I'm not trying to miss. And I totally can relate to that feeling of like, you know, going out there and trying, but just not, for whatever reason, you know, it not being there. And what is a coach's role in that situation? And probably to sum me out of the game in hindsight.
But. Yeah, and here's the other thing we talk about, because those moments are going to happen.
Yep.
We're going to screw up. You go back and apologize.
Yeah.
It's not brain surgery. But sometimes we have this pride of I can't, you know, if I apologize to an 18-year-old kid, they're going to take me. No, they're not.
Mm.
I think it's like most of the time. There's always exceptions. Everybody listening can probably think of an exception. But
no, that's good.
When somebody comes, hey, my bad, I really screwed up, it makes me like them more, you know, and respect them more.
The generational characteristics have changed. The human condition has still not changed.
Right.
People appreciate people who give back. People appreciate people who admit. And again, part of that competence and caring is saying, hey, guys, I might have missed it on this one. And the buy-in that you get by being human with a team – my goodness. And that's again, huge. Why don't we do it as young coaches? Fear.
Yeah.
We don't know that's okay. Or what we had modeled in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that wasn't modeled by other leaders and definitely coaches, why would we think to do that, right?
Yeah, that's really good. We've been cruising. We're 45 minutes in. Do you guys have time for one more question?
Yep. Let's do it.
Okay. So really great conversation on that. This last question is a little bit of a curveball, but it relates to leadership and probably coaching as well. And it came from Jared sent this in. He said, what does Jesus mean when he tells his disciples to be shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves? What are the implications of that statement for Christian leadership? That was a good question.
It's a good question. We both had to research it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate questions that maybe get in the scripture. You know, Well, I will say this, and I'll let the doctor talk. When I read over Matthew 10, and the whole context of that passage, one, I felt really encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
I felt strengthened by what Jesus is telling the disciples.
Right.
And I felt like a here and now, if we believe that, right, we surrender our lives to Jesus,
right,
and the same power that rose him from the dead lives in us in the Holy Spirit. Then there was part of me that's like, man, I have more power than I often think.
Right.
That line specifically, shrewd as snakes, innocent as doves, the words that I wrote down were the wisdom to function in all areas. So, I mean, what he says in that passage is pretty real.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's not going to be easy.
Nope.
And my understanding of that, like, it doesn't end. You keep going. But how do we have the wisdom to function in all areas or arenas? And so I think it's a powerful description of how we're called to follow Christ.
Yeah.
So when you say that from leadership, I think for me it's saying, and I don't want to take it out of context, so you can you can definitely hop in, but do I have the wisdom in all settings, right, to be rooted in my beliefs and yet be able to be in all different environments? Mm-hmm. Rob, say more. Say less. Say more.
I think you said it well. I went and read some commentary from Piper on
nice.
It.
Nice.
And his take, he kind of went descriptive on like serpents, snakes. The language is interesting because I take shrewd as a bad term.
Right.
And
initially, that's kind of how
I took it. And I don't think that's what the passage is. But snakes have an awareness to get out of the way quick.
Yeah.
And he put it, at least the commentary I read that included him, within the context of sharing the gospel, mm-hmm. of communicating who Jesus is, of if you're in a place where people aren't open to that, get out of the way, and then be innocent as doves, meaning have a character and have a way you treat people that isn't going to undercut the gospel for the way to hear it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm not a theologian.
No, I think all that's good, especially within the context of the sheep among wolves and all of that. I think shrewdness has an air of being able to make quick judgments.
Mm-hmm.
You even think about like that same term is used in some of the parables mm-hmm. of that Jesus tells in regards to making swift judgment on mm-hmm. something. So how do we able to make quick, hard decisions while checking our motives? The word that comes to mind is meek, right? Jesus mm-hmm. says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the world. And when we think meek, oftentimes we think it rhymes with weak. We don't think of it as a virtue. In fact, our culture doesn't really think of it as a virtue. But the proper definition of meek is strength restrained, right? To have the ability to overpower and dominate, but to not unless it's necessary. Yeah. And I think of there's a great story this guy. It's like 500 BC in Rome, named Cincinnatus. It's actually kind of what the city Cincinnati is named after. But he was a farmer, right? Just kind of living his life. But he was known throughout the region as a super wise. And the Roman officials would go and seek out wisdom from him during times of crisis. And there was a time when Rome was being ambushed by another colony. So they went and found Cincinnatus. And Cincinnatus told his wife, he said, hey, we're going to have to not till the crops for a year. I have to go and help with the situation. So he gathered up all these like ragtag farmers and young boys and men and got basically an army together, helped defend Rome and accomplished amazing things. And afterwards was paraded around as this like amazing figure. They wanted him to be king. And he told them, he said, no, I need to go home to my wife. And so then he went home, farmed just normal life in obscurity until he died. And it's this kind of picture of meekness, right? The guy had the power to be king. And for a season, he used that power to accomplish what he needed to accomplish. But instead of letting that power take over his drive, he put it aside, went home, tilled his crops. And I think that's the third, because what do we know about power? Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
All of us in positions of leadership have a certain amount of power. But that power, I think, if our motivations, right, aren't innocent as doves, if they're not driven by the right things, that power can lead to, I think, a really unhealthy, and you've seen leaders who are domineering. You've seen coaches who use their power and authority to demean and to bring shame on people. Whereas being shrewd as a serpent, having a meek disposition, that's the kind of, I think, Christ-like use of power. Because when we talk about Christ, we talk about power. We talk about, you know, power in us, but what's the inverse of the kingdom? Weakness, right? When we are weak, he is strong. So there's just like really interesting, you can almost say meekness is more like humility than it is weakness, but it's also power.
It's amazing how the secular world and this aligns with the spiritual.
Right.
Because as you're talking, I think kind of a business book everybody reads in school called Good to Great.
Yeah.
And for those that haven't read it, I mean, the book studies the difference between good companies and great companies, yep, as defined by outperforming the market by a certain percentage. And a Stanford researcher named Jim Collins studied it, and he said he found some commonalities among the high-performing companies. Mm. And one of them, I think he called it level five leadership. But he said these leaders that ran these companies weren't kind of the, I don't know, the buffoon type, right, let me flex kind of guys.
Yep.
They had, he said, intense professional willpower to, yep, make big decisions and stand, right, by them with a combination of humility. Mm. He said those who, I think that's what I hear you saying,
absolutely,
is those leaders that are leading the biggest companies in the world, the most successful companies in the world, professional resolve with significant humility.
Yeah.
And that's meekness. I mean,
it is.
Yeah.
I think of George Washington, who, you know, they wanted him to be king when they defeated the British. They wanted him to be heralded. And he's like, no, I need checks and balances. And, yeah, so he became president. And then when he was done, stepped down. And you think about leaders who have that, for so many, it's once you get a taste of power, it's how much power can I get? But the ability to lay down, mm-hmm, that power, I think, is an insight into Jesus' leadership. You know, there was a time when Jesus flipped over the tables and brought out the whip. But that wasn't his like natural bent. He wasn't doing that on the reg. That was a very unique instance.
Mm-hmm. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know how we top that.
That's a great way to wrap this up.
Amen.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Let me, real quick, before we let you guys go, share a little bit more about, just plug your stuff with ICP. Give me a little bit more. Where can people find you? Podcasts, website. Give us a little bit of that, and then we'll
A couple different spots. We have a Substack, which I talked about at the beginning, which is Impactful Coaching Project at Substack.com. We put some out weekly. Take you 2 minutes to read. Working on a full website. We're doing speaking engagements. We're coming out to Eastminster for the men's retreat here in a couple weeks. So that's a piece. We have our podcast called Beyond Coaching, which were 7 or 8 episodes released. We have about 25 in the queue ready to go. And then we're working on 2 books that we're hoping are done this summer. One is Coaching the 21st Century Athlete that we're writing together. And then we're doing another one that I'm writing for 80s athletic directors. So people that supervise coaches, just a potential system for leadership and how to create an environment where holistic coaching and leadership is valued. So did I miss anything, Dustin?
I think you nailed it.
Love it.
And Dustin's one of the, if he's not one of the best speakers in the country, I don't know who is. So I don't even have to come. Call him and have him speak. I'm the boring one.
I'm looking forward to it. And I want to thank you guys for giving me an hour. This is great. I feel like we could have gone another hour, but we got stuff to do. So thank you for doing this. And thank you for listening. Send in your questions, betterquestions@eastminster.org, or check out our website, eastminster.org/betterquestions. Thanks again, guys. See you next time. Grace and peace.